January 15th, 1967, on a bright, clear day in the Los Angeles Coliseum, the big question which had troubled the football world for 7 years was answered. For the first time, the Green Bay Packers, champions of the National Football League, played the Kansas City Chiefs, the best team in the American Football League. The game was the first concrete evidence of the merger of the two leagues, and it was played for the highest stakes ever, $15,000 per man for the winning players. The Super Bowl was seen by the largest sports audience in the history of television. 65 million people watching the broadcast on two networks.
53 years ago, I watched the first Super Bowl when I was a boy. The Packers and the Kansas City Chiefs. And the Packers, of course, won. I was 11 years old in 1967, the year I stole the Odyssey from that kid at school. Sorry, kid, but I stole it because I needed it, and I still have it, and I'm not giving it up. The 60s, you may forget or you may not know, was a time when kids would duck and cover in school. We'd stick our heads under our desks, cover up, and protect us from nuclear war. Yeah, it was kind of stupid, but it did promote one thing. It promoted fear. And some kids, 53 years from now, if there is such a thing as a Super Bowl, we'll remember fear and masks and no school and teachers and journalists, some including sports writers, instructing them how to think, instructing them how to think in the politically correct way. We didn't have that then. But we did have dystopian post-apocalyptic science fiction when I was a boy. It's not really popular now because, well, dystopia is our new reality. And it's not fiction. And sometimes in those novels, you'd run across an archetypical character. Usually a man, sometimes a monk, or a pretend monk, or an embittered atheist, wearing his skin like iron, his breath smelling of kerosene. These were human books. Grizzled, white-haired, clear-eyed, who'd keep memory alive for generations who didn't know about the past, and never would experience it, never would know what it was like. And he'd travel between the camps of those nomads in the apocalyptic dystopian world. He'd tell stories for food. He'd remember things that were of distant memory to the old warlords of those camps. He'd talk of candy bars, canned peaches, opening a pack of cigarettes, music on the radio, newspapers, or cultural amusements in the time before the hectoring of the coronavirus Karens. As the philosopher Robert Downey Jr. said once in a Rodney Dangerfield movie, what did he say?
Come on, man, it's a pep rally for the football team of the Union. Let's go over there.
Whoa, wait, what is this?
All right, me and Standish and Redding doing the anti-pep rally. You know, we're pointing out that violent ground acquisition games such as football is, in fact, a crypto-fascist metaphor for nuclear war.
Well, it sounds like a lot of laughs,
said Robert Downey Jr., Iron Man, in Back to School. Nuclear war? Duck and cover? Packers and the Chiefs? Iran testing nuclear missiles now, or let's say they're testing missiles now, because they're not afraid of the current president? Hey, don't talk to me about politics. Today we're talking about football with Dan Pompey, my friend and one of the best football writers in America. But for a few beats, let me keep carrying that grizzled white-haired book archetype in the dystopian fiction of years ago. What about the Super Bowl? You remember the Super Bowl? Americans would gather without masks in bars and restaurants and cheer for their team and make bets and tease each other and have fun watching that great ground acquisition game. And doing it all while stuffing various fats and salts into our faces to have a great old time. Remember them? Remember football? Remember chips with Mrs. Grass onion soup dip mix at Super Bowl parties? You can make all your Super Bowl concoctions that you find in magazines, all your little wraps, your crudités, your celery with ranch dressing. And you could make Kentucky bourbon wings like Wings Meisner did. I remember doing that for a Super Bowl. But when it comes to Mrs. Grass onion soup dip mix, sour cream, and Ruffles chips, there is no substitute. It's a Southside delicacy. So don't bring me your weak sauce Lipton or your Dean's from the store. If it's not Mrs. Grass onion soup dip mix and sour cream with a whiskey and soda, forget about it. Did I mention Dan Pompey? If you're a football fan in Chicago or a football fan across the country, anywhere, you know him. He's written for both the Sun-Times and the Tribune. He writes for now for The Athletic, a great sports site. He's in the NFL Football Hall of Fame. You hear him on The Score. You listen to sports radio, and I do. Or you read him, and I hope you do, in The Athletic, and I'm a subscriber. You know why I subscribe? Because it's a great sports site. You can read about all sports, not the politics of sports or the political thoughts of kickers or quarterbacks. Do you really care what a linebacker thinks about Iran testing missiles? Do you really care what a congressman, particularly some do-nothing congressman from Illinois, cares about sports? Like those stupid wagers that mayors have with each other? I don't. You know why Dan is good? Because he understands sports readers. He understands sports. He writes about it eloquently and passionately. He writes about it with a human heart. Because he has a human heart. And it's gone through some tough times. And he's still a good man. And that comes through too. Dan Pompey started me in the business when we were kids in college. One day he asked me to join him for a meeting, editorial meeting, at the Red, White, and Green Italian-American sports paper. We used to argue, you know, who's going to be on the cover? Joe Montana, Tony Esposito, Phil Esposito, Mario Andretti. We'd meet at Gene's Deli in Elmwood Park. George Randazzo was the director of the Italian-American Hall of Fame, Sports Hall of Fame. good guy, and he gave us all the chance to write. That's all we wanted. We'll talk about all this with Dan Pompey. And Jeff Carlin is here, too, always, as always, the co-host of this podcast, executive producer at WGN Radio. You know something? You see all these Hall of Fame, even the radio, even WGN does it. Hall of Fame for radio people. Well, you know what? Jeff Carlin should be in the Hall of Fame of radio. Because he's a pro's pro, like Dan. And if we sound halfway decent, it's because Jeff makes it so. And me? I'm John Cass, soccer fan, husband, father, syndicated columnist at the Chicago Tribune, member of its editorial board. And where are you? Trying to remember what it was like at Super Bowl parties? When you could walk into a bar or restaurant, see a game on TV? Or have that Mrs. Grass's onion soup dip mix at home with the whiskey and soda? And if so, then I'll be there too. Remembering it all, how it once was, like some grizzled human book. You're on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand with pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
If you're a Chicago sports fan, you know the name of Dan Pompey. He's covered football for the Sun-Times, for the Chicago Tribune, and now writes for The Athletic. And you can find his work on at The Athletic. I'm a subscriber because of Dan and Paul Tenorio and Guillermo Rivera, because I want to read sports. I'm always into politics myself. And when I read sports, I want to read sports. And I can't think of a better guest right before the Super Bowl than the man who's in the Hall of Fame, Dan Pompey, my friend, who got me into the business years ago, many years ago, when we were kids at Columbia College. Dan asked me one day, "What are you doing on a Saturday? What are you doing this Saturday? You want to come out to a meeting?" And I came out to a meeting of the Italian American Sports Hall of Fame newspaper, which was the Red, White, and Green. And in those days, the only thing we argued about was whether to put Joe Montana or Tony Esposito on the cover. Maybe Boom Boom Mancini. Welcome to the Chicago Way, Dan.
Hey, it's great to be with you, John. You know, I have so much respect for you professionally and personally. And, you know, I really always think back fondly on our time together back in college, and enjoy reading you. You're a great pro and, you know, one of the great columnists in the country. And I'd love to talk anything with you. It's good to be with you.
Well, I'd like to ask you first. We got a lot of, I put it out on Facebook, and I think you liked it, so that was cool. There was one from Elaine Bezbakos. A reader says, "I know Dan's cousin very well, Lisa Brancato. She's very proud of her cuz." So do you want to say hello to Lisa?
Lisa. And, you know, Lisa's son, Nick, actually has his own podcast, and I just was a guest on his podcast too, and that was kind of fun.
So, what is it?
It's, you know, he's a young man who's doing interviews with people kind of about overcoming things in life and what you need to do to succeed at life. And it's a really interesting concept. And he's had some interesting guests and he's just started it recently. And I think it's got a lot of potential.
Dan Pompey spans the life of NFL football for like, I think 30 plus years. One of our friends, mutual friends, Mark Farina weighed in because Marky was in those meetings with all of us and weighed in. Wonderful memories of those days in suburban Elmwood Park, meaning at the Red, White, and Green. Dan Pompey is also a member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame as a recipient of the Dick McCann Award for Distinguished Contributions to Pro Football and Sports Writing. Did you ever think when you were a kid that you'd be in the Hall of Fame, man?
Well, you know, I got to tell you, that honor really kind of took me aback. It wasn't something I ever expected. And certainly not at the age that it happened for me. I think I was in my, how old was I? I was maybe 53 or something when it happened. So, it's just a great honor. You know, it's one of those kind of life memories that you'll always have, you know, kind of like getting married or something like that, where, it was very significant to me. And, it really was what it meant was, I think that a lot of other writers, because the award is voted on by writers, I think I bought them a lot of beer. So they felt like they should give me this award.
Maybe you threw them a few quotes on deadline when you had enough, you know?
There you go. Something like there
that. You go. That's one thing I could never understand, and you've done it all your life. The thing about sports, I mean, when something happens, there's a big event in Chicago, like a news event, and I'm expected to write on it the next day and not to wait 3 days, you know, to figure out what the consensus is. And that's tough enough. But I never understood how sports writers, because I've tried it and I can't do it, can write about something that hasn't ever it hasn't ended yet. How do you begin a story that hasn't ended?
Yeah, that's to me was always the most challenging part of being a sports writer. When you're watching a night event like the upcoming Super Bowl,
yeah, and
your deadline might be sometimes it's, you know, 15 minutes after the game. In some extreme cases, the deadline is before the game ends, and you have to write what they just call kind of a filler story as the game is going on with play by play and different things. But, you know, there are some people who are just masterful at being able to do that and being able to kind of give you a microwave reaction and put it in context as to what happened, why, and how. I was never very good at that, and I'm glad I don't have to do it anymore. What I do now mostly is just write long features and do some commentary on the Bears.
Well, you're on the Score. I know that because I listen to the Score. What else are you doing? You're at the Athletic. What else?
That's it, really. That's enough to keep me busy. Yeah. I spend most of my time on the long form features, and which I really enjoy doing. And it's been something that I've kind of migrated to later in my career. You know, I did some of them earlier, but to kind of major in them has been a new thing for me, and I've really enjoyed it. It's really been a challenge for me to be good at it and to kind of keep evolving. And that's the thing, you know, how the business has changed so much, John, since you and I got into it.
Right.
And, you know, it's created or caused guys like you and I to change with it and to keep evolving and to find different ways to do the job. And that's been a good thing. And obviously, change sometimes can be hard. I think we all have a natural resistance to it. But I think when you embrace it and you do your best to kind of try to see where the future is heading and be a part of it, it can be a very good thing.
One of the long form features, and you were writing them years and years ago at the Sun-Times and at the Trib. But what I read the feature you did on Ron Rivera, former linebacker for the Chicago Bears, now coach of the Washington almost wait the Washington football team, right? What of his?
Got it right. You got it right.
Yeah, and he and his suffering and dealing with a crazy football team, a nutball owner, and cancer at the same time. That was just insane and such a quality bit of writing. I think it's because, Dan, that your humanity comes through in writing this kind of piece. And Rivera, that you've known probably for 30 years or so, really trusted you to talk about it.
Yeah, it was kind of a unique circumstance. And yeah, you talk about the humanity. I think that's really important in what I do, being able to understand people, relate to people. That's one of the things about the pandemic that's been difficult for me, is because I always like to kind of look someone in the eye. I think you're able to kind of establish a trust and an understanding with someone when you're in the same room with them, and you're able to shake their hands, and you're able to see their face, and they're able to see your face. And we haven't been able to do that. Obviously, we have Zoom, which is better than nothing, but I'll look forward to the day when we get back to that. As far as Rivera, yeah, you're right. You know, I've known him since, I think, 1984, and always has been one of my favorite people in the business. And so it was wonderful that he did trust me to tell this story, and he gave me the time. You know, it's hard to get a head coach in the National Football League to commit to really give you the kind of time you need to write this story in the middle of a season. And I think the first time we talked for about an hour and a half on one of the days off. And then we talked more after that, you know, in subsequent conversations. But it was really a unique situation that he was in, with all these crazy things happening, and then, you know, fighting for his life basically on top of it. So,
and then also having that quarterback thing going on.
Yeah. Yeah. With Dwayne Haskins kind of going off the reservation, and, you know, Alex Smith trying to come back from this incredible injury that he had, and, you know, another quarterback getting hurt along the way. And then, you know, it was really a unique set of circumstances. Matter of fact, Ron called me yesterday morning, because I texted him, and he recently was diagnosed as being cancer free. So I just texted him congratulations, and he called me. We had a nice little conversation.
That's good.
It's such a great story. I mean, the way you kind of broke down the way his family, you know, telling, making the call to his parents and talking to his dad, and then the story of his dad's own cancer issue coming up out of the woodwork that they didn't even know. I mean, cancer touches so many people's lives in this country that part of it to me really stood out. You captured it really well, the idea as best you could, really, to feeling of when cancer hits a family, you know, it hits everybody. And it was really powerful to me.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Jeff. You know, I think cancer has touched almost everybody, right? In some way, shape, or form. We've all dealt with a loved one or had it ourselves or whatever. And, or if a good friend. So I think it's something that everyone could relate to. And, you know, that's the beauty of writing these kinds of stories. You know, it's not just always about what somebody does with a football in his hand or baseball, whatever. It's, you know, what was going on behind the scenes that either helped him do what he was trying to do, or, you know, it was a hurdle that he had to get over. I mean, everyone's got a great story in life. That's one of the things I've learned. Everyone's got a great story. It's just a matter of whether or not someone like me or John can get it out of them and then have the ability to tell the story the right way.
I think the reason why you're so good at this is because you have empathy for these tremendous athletes that you don't, you know, we all start out like, you in sports, and I'll just speak about myself, me in politics. where I was looking at these politicians early on, I was, you know, overwhelmed by their power, their quick wit, their ability to, you know, get me so-and-so on the phone, and the guy gets on the phone and does what they want them to do. And the reach. So it was like dealing with a group of bosses, and you get your head turned. But as you go on in life, you start seeing people as, you know, fellow human beings, in these amazingly difficult and stressful situations. And I know a pro football player. My cousin Freddie played, 12, 15 years in the NFL?
Yeah, heck of a player.
Yeah, he was, Danny. Nose guard. You know, the biggest Greek in the world, I guess. I remember Dan, when he came over to my dad's and mom's place with Chris and Marco Island, he was still playing. He was playing for Buffalo. And he'd lift, you know, even during the days off, I mean, during the vacation time, he'd lift in the morning and work out in the afternoon. And so for lunch, he'd eat, you know, thank God we were butchers, you know, for lunch, he'd eat two chickens, and for dinner, he'd have like two porterhouse steaks. I mean, and the way they protected and worked on their bodies in those days as they were developing, and the trials and difficulties they went through just to stay in the league, which we don't even see. We're just fans, and we just see the, you know, Dan, we just see the scores and the highlights and, you know, the tackles being made, and we don't see those. But you, as such an experienced NFL writer with the Bears and with other teams and just the whole league, you know, you've seen these guys, you've seen these kid rookies coming through the game, and now they're coaches. You've seen them go through all these changes, and you have that humanity. I think, isn't that what makes the good writer, is the ability to see your subjects as human, not as things.
Yeah, and you do that very well, obviously. You also, I think, are able to relate to the reader very well in your columns. And
well, it depends on who's reading it, right? Well, we're not going to be talking. I don't want to talk about me, because I've got a lot of haters out there, and I just want all love directed to Dan Pompey. But, Dan, I have to ask you, people are going to be asking me, and they have been messaging me. They want to know two things, mainly. They want to know about the Bears, and they want to know about the trade with Goff and the Rams and all that. So, and for Stafford. So which do you want to go first? Go first.
Well, I'll tell you a little about the Stafford-Goff trade between the Lions and the Rams. Just my quick take on this is that, you know, when I look at that trade, I just see desperation everywhere. I see the desperation for the quarterback position, because there just are not, never have been, never will be enough good quarterbacks to go around the National Football League. So the Rams showed desperation when they chose Jared Goff number one overall, because he probably wasn't worthy of number one pick. Then they showed desperation by making him one of the highest paid quarterbacks in the game, even though he really probably hadn't played up to that. And now, a couple of years later, they're showing desperation and, you know, giving up on him and going in a different direction and trading, you know, just a boatload of resources right to the Lions to try to get another quarterback who really never had great success in Detroit. You know, here was a guy, I mean, he did some things statistically that were very impressive, but it's not like they're trading all these resources for Tom Brady in his prime, or, you know, Patrick Mahomes, or even Deshaun Watson, you know? So I think, like I said, that trade, just, I see desperation everywhere. In terms of the Bears, is there a specific question that you or a reader had, or do you just want to give my general take?
Give us your general impression about a team where, you know, I give that the Mutsa every month, and I gave it to Ryan Pace because he now I'm not trying to put you in a trick bag with him, but because I always thought that there are a lot of good coaches, many, many great coaches throughout a sport on all different levels. The thing that separates them to me is players. And if you don't have the players, if you have the great players, you're a great coach. And if you don't have the great players, you're not a great coach. So that was my take. But what's yours? I mean, how long is it going to take? We saw we see the Packers, you know, dominating and Aaron Rodgers smirking. When I see him smirking, it just kills me, man.
Yeah, it's the old saying, it's not about the X's and O's, it's about the Jimmys and the Joes. You know, you've got to get the players. And the Bears are kind of starting over now. You know, Pace made a critical error at the quarterback position when he rated Mitch Trubisky ahead of Deshaun Watson and Patrick Mahomes, and then traded up for Trubisky, you know, just gave up so much, the second pick of the draft. And that's a tough thing to get over. You know, that's a mistake that's going to set you back, you know, minimum. It's already set them back 5 years. It's probably going to set them back, you know, more. We'll see how they're able to try to climb out of the hole they're in. But everything depends on what they're able to acquire at the quarterback position now. You know, are they going to go for a quick fix and try to bring in a big name and who can contribute this year because they feel like they've got other pieces in place who can help them contend now? Or are they going to try to rebuild a little bit and go young and try to get a quarterback who can be here for 10 years and be a part of everything they're doing moving forward? I mean, it's tough. It's tough to go find that quarterback. I mean, like I said earlier about the Lions and the Rams, they just don't exist. And when they do exist, it's hard to evaluate them the right way. I mean, so many teams make mistakes at the quarterback position over and over again. And the Bears have been probably the worst of any over time at trying to evaluate that position, not only evaluate, but develop. You know, I think that's the other part of it. It's one thing to find the guy. Then it's another thing. I mean, you look at the way the Packers developed Aaron Rodgers. He sat for 2 years behind Brett Favre. And then, you know, they brought him along and they had good coaching. Obviously they had some really good offensive minds around him. And they put good players around him, especially earlier in his career, I think.
But he didn't have six different offensive coordinators in his first 6 years. He didn't have all those different quarterback coaches. I mean, to me, that I don't know how a young athlete, no matter what the sport, can develop when he's constantly dealing with, look at what Cutler. I mean, okay, people didn't like him, his personality, whatever, but there are a lot of different coaches, a lot of different coordinators. I don't know how you're supposed to develop with that.
Well, that's why, you know, I'm never really a big advocate of firing everybody. I mean, everyone always wants to say that's the solution. Fire Nagy, fire this guy, fire that. Right. You know, you cannot win the National Football League if you are cleaning house every other year. You're going to turn into the worst franchise in the league by doing that. I mean, unless you know for sure that the people you are talking about firing are completely incompetent. And that's not the case with Matt Nagy. It's not even the case with Ryan Pace. You know, I mean, I just said he made a terrible mistake, but you know, these guys have done good things. They've shown the ability to, I think, learn from mistakes and grow. But I think, you know, there needs to be internal change, if not change in people. They need to reevaluate the way things have been done and try to find a better way.
I guess the one person I feel sorry for in all that is Virginia McCaskey. And you've written eloquently about her as well, the 97-year-old matriarch of the family. I just feel sorry for her. I do.
I do too. I mean, it's hard for her because, you know, I know everyone wants to win for her. I know there are employees of the team who tell me, you know, that's why I want to work for the Bears, Virginia McCaskey. I want to give her a championship before it's too late. And, you know, she's a wonderful woman. When Dan Pearson and I wrote the book about the Bears' centennial anniversary a couple of years ago, he and I...
Another Hall of Famer, Dan Pearson from the Trib.
Yeah. The great Dan Pearson. He and I spent over 20 hours with her, interviewing her about, you know, the entire history of the team. And it was wonderful to get her perspective and to see at her age how sharp she was. I mean, she remembers things that I certainly don't remember that I lived through. And to hear her tell the stories and relate personal stories about players and their wives and their families. You know, she would tell you a story about a guy from the 1940s, you know, and it was truly a special experience for Don and I.
Ed Obradovich is a friend of ours and a listener, and also, you know who he is. He's on the Bears post-game, or used to be, right after the Bears games on WGN, which I love because there was nothing like watching those guys. I mean, that was the most entertaining part of the afternoon when the Bears would give the ball away in the fourth quarter and lose, maybe try to do something fancy on the goal line and never put it in when they had to. And those two guys, Hampton and OB, would just erupt, which was fun. You know, it was like cathartic.
Oh, the best.
Right? But he says that the rules have changed so much that has increased the reliance on the quarterback. And I asked him, well, why don't the Bears go and focus on their interior line, particularly, you know, offensive line, defensive line. And he made some kind of crack like, oh, and then you want them to throw to the tight ends like all Bears fans do. Something like that. But what about that? What about if the Bears could, you know, maybe live with Trubisky or, okay, let me say it, a Ryan Fitzpatrick or somebody, right? Just somebody to sit there and take the snap and develop the team from the spine outward or upward rather than from the head down.
Well, you know, that was what Jim Finks had in mind when he came to the Bears.
Oh, he did okay. Well, didn't he do all right? Didn't he set up?
I think he did okay. In the 1970s, he came here and he said, I'm going to build the lines first. The lines are the most important thing. Now, the game has changed a little since then, but I think it still goes. I mean, I think you still want to be strong on both lines. And, you know, it's easier to be strong on both lines than it is at the quarterback position. Now, are you going to win a Super Bowl right now with, you know, strong lines and Trubisky or strong lines and Ryan Fitzpatrick when you have to go against Patrick Mahomes or Tom Brady? Probably not. But I think you could be a contender. You could be a team that, you know, goes into the playoffs, and you never know what happens when you get there. You know, if the other team gets a bad break in some way, shape, or form, maybe something goes your way. And you know, like I said, you have to develop quarterbacks. That's the thing. I've always been a proponent of drafting a quarterback every year. And I wrote a column recently on The Athletic. You know, I would keep three quarterbacks on the active roster, another one on the practice squad, and I would have a separate coach in charge of developing these guys. And I would make sure that the young guys are preparing for their future, not part of that week's game preparation. That's the problem. These guys never get developed. The only thing they sit there and watch the veterans take snaps in practice. They don't even take snaps.
Right.
And, you know, then the day comes when there's disaster and they're thrown in the mix and they, you know, and they pee down their leg. Well, big surprise there. Right.
Right. Right.
So, you know, you need to work with these guys, develop them, and try to see if they have something that's worthwhile in them to keep them. Otherwise, you need to move on and find the next young guy.
What you're describing is familiar to Jeff, who's, by the way, his athletic accomplishments need no repeating, but I'll do it.
Thanks.
Former keeper for the Palatine Celtic soccer club. But what you're describing, Dan, is the development of players the way top soccer teams develop their players in Europe, particularly in Germany, where the young players are playing. They're playing in other leagues, but they're playing either they're loaned out or they're playing on their junior teams, and they're developing. It's not about throwing them in there with the Lions, with the Alpha Lions on their, you know, when they're not ready.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think the NFL is one of the worst professional sports at developing players because, you know, there's no minor leagues.
Well, they have that's college football. That's the minor league.
Well, I guess college is a minor league, but you know, there's not really an opportunity for these guys to develop and learn slowly. They're thrown in and they're expected to perform quickly. And you wonder sometimes about what a guy could have been. I mean, I'll give you an example. I wrote earlier this year about Henry Burris, who joined the Bears this year as a coach, and he was with the team, you'll recall, I think it was, I want to say 2001. I might be off on that. But he played in one game, basically, you know, same kind of thing I was describing. Was thrown in, was awful. And then they moved on. He went to the Canadian League. What did he do in the Canadian League? Well, he became a Hall of Famer. He won, I think it was 3 championships, played in 2 more. You know, could he have done the same or I shouldn't say done the same, but could he have enjoyed a measure of success in the National Football League if someone had developed him, spent time with him, and, you know, invested in him?
I guess you could ask Warren Moon, right?
That's a good question, right? Yeah. Right. I mean,
yeah, clearly he had the physical and emotional ability to do it. I mean,
absolutely. I mean, it's certainly one of those what ifs that we can never answer, but we should have been able to answer it, put it that way.
Well, one thing I want to ask, and I know Jeff, when I told Jeff I was going to ask you to be on, Jeff, and of course chime in here with any questions.
Yeah.
Is the when I mentioned that you helped get me into the business, and we worked at the Red, White, and Green with I don't know a murderer's row of young sports writer talent. We worked for George Randazzo. There was Dan Pompey, Mark Farina. Give me some other names, Danny.
Well, Bob Laguerre, who was a beat man for the Daily Herald for many years. Barry Rosner, who still is the Bears, a columnist, sports columnist at the Daily Herald. Dom Sienna, who for many years was with St. John's as their one of their media relations people. Phil Kozin, who was a radio show golf writer before his passing. I could go on. There are many others. Paula Bovin, who was a columnist for the Arizona Republic for many years. It was quite a group.
I love the old story. So, Dan, you got to give me a little rub on John, something I can tease him with later as a young pub reporter.
Yeah.
You know, there was nothing to tease John about because we all just were in awe of him and his ability. And, you know, he was one of the guys, I could tell you this, who I thought right away could really be something special because of the way he asked questions, the way he wrote, great writing ability, obviously. And then in addition to that, he had this worldview, this perspective that most people don't have that.
Yeah. Because you know, they're sane. They're not insane.
Well, no, I think a lot of people don't consider that when you consider a journalist, but you know, really, it's like, you know, what is the breadth of your experiences? Where have you been? What do you, you know, what do you understand? How do you see things maybe differently from other people? And John had all those things.
I think one thing that we were all about, none of us were about the pedigree journalism school. Nobody had $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 to spend to go to Northwestern to be lectured in cultural Marxism by some failed professor. We went to Columbia. where there clearly were lefties, but they were pros and pros. And we understood that part of the business is to have a life before you begin passing judgment or writing about other people's lives, to have your own life first, to start a life. And okay, I'll tell you one. So Danny, so I wanted to be the boxing writer, and I thought I was going to be like a combination of, I mean, typical kid, you know, typical idiotic kid. I was going to be like an AJ Liebling type of writer and write about all these characters. And so I think one day we went to the, what was the name of, with the Cupids that pee in the fountain, Da Vinci Manor. Okay. On the West Side, it was on Fullerton where they used to have boxing shows. Benny Bentley would be the announcer. And I was there, and then I ran into an old man. I would say he was a very respected old man in that neighborhood and elsewhere, somewhat feared. I'm not going to say his name, but he's like, "Oh, you're the boxing writer." And I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "Okay, see that corner?" And I said, "Yeah." He goes, "What color is it?" I said, "That's the red corner." He goes, "Right. And see that corner? What color is it?" And I said, "That's the blue corner." "Right." And he goes, "See, the red corner is for the prospects, and the blue corner is for the opponents. Do you understand sports now?" I said, "Yes, sir, I do. Thank you, sir."
And you learned more that night than you probably could have learned it 4 years at Medill, right?
I learned a lot that night, my friend, I tell you.
Well, you know, that was the beauty of, I think, the way we did it, even though maybe we would have liked to have done it another way, is that I think it was a very practical education. You know, our school, I think, had that philosophy. And then the way that we kind of did things even outside of school, you know, we learned how to do things instead of just, you know,
how to think about it.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
So tell me this, Danny. So you started at when did you start at the Sun Times?
So at Columbia, right when I was there. Were you in Kevin Lamb's class? I don't think you were.
I never got a degree from Columbia because I got that internship at the Daily Calumet and never went back. And they asked me for money, but they won't give me an honorary degree. So I say no money.
Well, anyway, Kevin Lamb was one of my teachers at Columbia, and Kevin Lamb, who, for those of you who don't remember, was a great Bears writer at the Sun Times.
Yes, he was.
And he was kind enough to help me, you know, just kind of understand what was involved in the job and that sort of thing. And at one point, I told him, I said, "Look, if there's ever a job available at the Sun Times, let me know." And he came to me one day and said, "You know, they need someone to type in Agate and answer the phones."
I remember that when you went over there to do that. We were so excited. It was like awesome.
Yeah. He said, "You know, it's not a great job. You got to work till 2 a.m. and all this." But I jumped at it while I was in school, and I started there. And then I stayed there after I graduated. I kept doing the same thing. I turned down some opportunities to go be a writer just to stay there and be around all that. You know, that was kind of like the golden age of Sun Times when Royko and Ebert and John Shulian were there, and the sports department was just, you know, brimming with talent. And then Rupert Murdoch bought the paper.
Those two were Royko and Ebert were obviously the big stars, but I always thought that John Shulian was the writer at that paper.
He was unbelievable. I still miss reading him.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. But anyway, so then, you know, people started to leave because Murdoch bought the paper and they needed new blood, and they promoted me. And then I started writing about different things, college basketball, baseball. And then in 1985, the Bears got hot and they needed another body in the Bears, and they threw me out there, and I've been writing about NFL ever since.
To be a young sports writer getting his first break with the Bears on the way to that incredible season, Oh my God, Dan, that was just
storybook.
I know I sound like Eddie Obradovich now. Oh my God, but were you in Miami? Because I went to Miami with my brothers for that game, and I remember the Archbishop or the Cardinal of Miami coming onto the field and blessing the Dolphins, which almost made me want to scream heresy, heretic, heretic. and then you know what happened? The Bears lost that perfect season.
Yeah,
no,
yeah.
They won the Super Bowl.
Right, right. Well, they won the game that counted that year, but
yeah,
they lost that one.
I'd love to ask you, Dan. So, you know, one of the things John and I talk about here in the world of politics a lot is how Zoom has kind of changed the way that civic leaders, anybody has to really answer to someone like a reporter who's asking tough questions or who can get the truth. And since you're seeing it, you know, what did you think of this year and how sports was being covered and what maybe the downside or upside might be?
Well, you know, I think everybody made the best of it, but I don't think it's sustainable long term from the standpoint of a journalist, because, you know, you're not able to develop relationships on Zoom. You know, fortunately, somebody like John or myself, who's been at it for a long time, has a lot of pre-existing relationships and, you know, established contacts. But some of the younger guys are going to really struggle if all you could do is talk to somebody on Zoom. And, you know, the other thing about these Zoom press conferences that's difficult is that you don't always get to ask that follow-up question that you need.
Bingo.
It's really easy for the PR people or whoever it is who's orchestrating the press conference to just kind of give you what they want to give you, which, you know, is the bane of the journalist, right? Because you want to get what you are trying to get, not what they want to give you. So I think it's easier with Zoom for them to control the message.
And with that, I mean, one of the assumptions I think people don't really or pick up or even really think about is the idea that a lot of journalists are, you know, it's almost combat when you're going into asking questions of somebody. And it's not about, you know, what weapon you throw at them. It's how they react to it and what you can counter with. And you speak a little bit about that. I mean, you got the relationship. You're talking to us about how you had 20 hours with McCaskey. And, like, that sounds amazing. Like, you would get so much depth of detail. But if you've only got 20 minutes, you know, do you usually have a go-to piece they like to throw at somebody and then catch them off guard or follow up with them? Just a little of the mechanics of that, because it sounds so interesting to me to be in a scrum like that.
Well, I think, you know, you look at each individual circumstance differently, depending on what you're trying to get. I mean, your overriding goal is always to get the best information that you can get. You know, how do I tell a story in the best way I can? And, you know, every circumstance is unique that way, because, you know, you're dealing with different personalities, you're dealing with different interview hurdles, you're dealing with different stories, certainly different motivations from the people you're talking to. So you have to take all of that in account and draw up kind of a game plan for each circumstance that you go into, and make sure you're very well prepared. You know, you have to really be prepared for everything that could happen in the course of that interview, every piece of information that could be thrown at you that might surprise you.
And you don't go in with an attitude either. I mean, in sports news and politics, there's, like, you know, some columnists are nice guys, some columnists are rippers. I've been both. But you show up at a news conference and it's almost like you find yourself cast or predestined or ordained to fulfill a role. So, you know, the mayor shows up and is mad and you start pressing them, and other people build around that. And I don't know if that's really getting information as much as it is attitude. And you've always been about getting information, which, I mean, you could see the length of the career. I mean, and I think the breadth of knowledge. But in the Zoom world, Jeff, there's no give and take, right? For the rippers or for the nice guys or for the or for journalists who want complete information and would ask that question, that follow-up question, say of Nagy, like, why did you give Ryan, what's his name, that kid who, you know, the third string running back, the ball on third and two, and he couldn't make it, or something like that. And you don't see, you don't hear that.
Yeah, that's the problem with Zoom. But, you know, I think we've all got reputations, and most of them are pretty well earned, right? Based on our bodies of work, especially those of us who've been around a while. So I think it's always important to make sure that you make your reputation what you want it to be. You stand for the things you want to stand for. You know, that you'd be fair and accurate as a journalist and trustworthy. I don't see enough of that these days. I really don't. And that's one of the most disappointing things about where journalism has headed to me, because I think, you know, I see a lot of young kids come out with all kinds of strong opinions that aren't necessarily based on experience, or that their opinions oftentimes that they don't have the right to have. And you know, I don't think that serves your reader or your consumer well.
They have the right to have those opinions, but, and at the risk of sounding like those, like say Jerome Holtzman and those guys talking about Dan Pompey and John Cass when we were kids,
get off my lawn.
Yeah, get off my lawn. I'm screaming at clouds. Is that they haven't developed time in the business to really assess where they want to go. And so in the culture, the larger culture outside of sports or news, it's basically grabbing onto an attitude and putting it in your Twitter feed and blasting that out rather than reflection. So I think it's a cultural thing too. It's all tied into to culture. Culture is downstream of or sports writing and political writing are downstream of culture, right? And I think that that's a function.
Yeah, I would agree. And you know, the other thing that I don't see anymore in anything, and any vein of journalism, is a commitment to objectivity. You know, I think, you know, we see people take sides before they ask a question or before they sit down and start to write. And I don't know, that's not the way we were trained. And I don't think it's right. And I don't think it serves the consumer well.
Well, I think that what happens is the consumer goes, if you're going to tell me, if you're going to give me a steady diet, if I'm turning to the sports page and all I'm getting is a steady diet of politics, I'm out of there and I'm going to The Athletic. And guess what? I'm a subscriber. It's not that I don't like politics. There's certain parts of life that I don't want to have my food writers talking about my politics. I don't want to have sport. It's not that I don't think you know what you're doing, and you can't. You do know what you're doing, and you have the right to say it, but I have the right as a consumer. When I go to sports, man, I'm trying to get away. And I'm trying to escape, and I also look, Dan, for people who have the empathy, like you, to discuss these kids, not in terms of, you know, John, in the voice of John Facenda, like the gods of Olympus, but to discuss them with empathy, but also under a clear-eyed understanding that they're young people and they're human beings. And that's why I think you're one of the best, if not the best, around. And it is the Tribune's great loss that we don't have you anymore.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you saying that, John. And I enjoyed my time at the Tribune, but I was glad to get out of there. I'm in a better place now. So that's all I'll say about that subject.
Listen, Dan, if people want to read you, where do they go?
They could go to theathletic.com. They could follow me on Twitter at Dan Pompey. And I promise you, I will stick to sports because I believe, as John believes, that the people who follow me are interested in sports. And, you know, if you ever want to talk about politics or other things, I'd be happy to have a beer with you and we could sit down and hash it all out. But, you know, I think what I do and what gives me value to my readers is my thoughts and my experience and my expressions about sports and the NFL.
And it all started, everybody, at Gene's Deli in Elmwood Park when I'd get the hot Italian sub.
Oh, now you're making me hungry. I wish I could go back for one right now.
And we went to, I remember one time when we were going out with our girlfriends and became our wives. Where did we go? We went to some place on a Friday.
In Harlem Avenue.
It was like the place where all the bookies, it's like the big bookie, it was like Players, like everybody. It was like amazing.
D'Agostino's, right? The Augustino's.
Yeah. D'Agostino's it was.
And that's still there. We got to go there again.
All right, buddy. You're on. We'll go there the next time we're out in Elmwood Park.
That sounds good.
All right, buddy. Thanks, Dan.
My pleasure.
Dan Pompey, writer, 40 years in the business, my friend, and who got me into the business by saying, you want to write sports for the red, white, and green? Thanks, Danny.
Thanks, Dan.
Okay, guys, thank you.
See ya. For Dan Pompey, one of the best sports writers in the country, member of the Hall of Fame, writer now for The Athletic, athletic.com. I'm a subscriber. And for Jeff Carlin, executive producer, WGN Radio, and the best radio producer in Chicago. And me, I'm John Cass, husband, father, soccer fan. Still watch football. You have to have a whiskey and soda to deal with it, to deal with the moral issues. Thanks for joining us. And join us again, won't you, on our next edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.